Before we really get into the weeds today, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got this full Series 65 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. So definitely check it out at certfuel.com.
It is seriously a game changer for prep.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay,
so I want you to imagine a financial product that is so fundamentally complex, so like structurally bizarre, that it actually took an act of Congress and this brutal fight at the Supreme Court just to figure out who was even legally allowed to regulate it.
Yeah, and that is not an exaggeration, by the way.
Right. I mean, in 1959, the Supreme Court had to step in and rule on SEC versus Variable Annuity Life Insurance Company. And this was specifically because this product completely blurred the line between a traditional insurance policy and, well, a volatile stock market investment.
That was a massive regulatory turf war.
It really was. So today we are tearing apart the kind of murky and heavily tested world of insurance-based products for your Series 65 exam. We are looking at this massive stack of study notes covering annuities and life insurance.
And look, the mission here goes way beyond just, rote memorization.
Yeah.
Memorizing some list of rules about surrender charges or taxation phases, I mean, that'll only get you so far.
Yeah, the exam writers know exactly how to punish that surface level studying.
Exactly. We really have to deconstruct the architecture of risk here.
Yeah.
Because once you understand the underlying mechanics, specifically, who holds the bag when the market collapses, all these regulatory frameworks stop looking like just a random assortment of laws.
Right. They start looking like inevitable logic.
Yeah, precisely. You'll be able to spot the trick questions instantly because you'll understand the structural DNA of how these products actually work.
So to bring this abstract regulatory stuff into reality, we are going to follow the financial decisions of three specific individuals today. So meet our first character, Cautious Carl.
I love Carl.
Right. So Carl views the stock market as basically a legalized casino. He is terrified of volatility. He demands ironclad guarantees. He refuses to lose even a single penny of his principal. And he prefers his wealth to grow at a very slow, predictable, unexciting pace.
Which is fine. But contrasting Carl, we have volatile Valerie. And Valerie is, well, she's an adrenaline junkie when it comes to capital accumulation.
Wow, she loves the risk.
She really does. She understands that the stock market is this incredible wealth creation engine. And she demands maximum growth potential. She wants to dictate her own asset allocation. And she is perfectly willing to stomach, a 30% market drop if it means capturing the upside of a bull market.
She wants to be in the driver's seat entirely.
Right.
And rounding out our trio is Forgetful Fred. Now, Fred's primary function in life is to just stumble into the most heavily tested compliance traps on the Series 65.
He's a compliance nightmare.
Oh, walking disaster. He constantly attempts to make these redundant, highly penalized financial decisions that just trigger immediate alarm bells for both the SEC and the IRS. So our entire objective today is to help you pass this exam by basically diagnosing Fred's catastrophic mistakes before he even makes them.
And having those distinct risk profiles in mind is so crucial. It really sets the stage for the fundamental tension in this entire unit. Because the regulatory landscape for insurance products, it is not a single unified territory.
Yeah, it's totally split.
It is divided by this massive fault line.
Yeah, like if you look at the banking sector, the regulations are fairly uniform. But when you step into insurance products, all that diagnostic clarity just vanishes. We have this bizarre duality where some insurance products are regulated with draconian strictness by the SEC as pure securities.
Right, complete with prospectuses and all that federal oversight.
Exactly. But then, meanwhile, other insurance products sitting right next to them on the exact same broker's desk are completely ignored by the SEC and are overseen entirely by state-level insurance commissioners.
And the exam absolutely requires you to know exactly which side of that fault line a product sits on. But there is a golden rule to determine this, and it all boils down to two words.
Investment risk.
Yes. Investment risk. Whenever you encounter an insurance product on the Series 65, your immediate reflexive question just has to be, who bears the investment risk?
So let's trace the physical path of the money to answer that. Let's say a client hands over a $100,000 premium to an insurance company. The destination of those funds is what dictates the regulatory jurisdiction, right?
Exactly. So if the insurance company promises a guaranteed rate of return, let's just say a locked-in 4% yield, those funds are absorbed into the insurer's general account.
Okay, the general account. So what is that exactly?
The general account is essentially the massive, unified corporate balance sheet of the insurance company itself. They take your client's $100,000, They pool it with billions of dollars from all their other policyholders, and they deploy it into highly conservative long-duration assets.
Right. We are talking about investment-grade corporate bonds, government treasuries, commercial real estate mortgages.
Yeah, they are just trying to earn maybe 5 or 6% on that money so they can safely afford to pay your client that guaranteed 4%.
But the critical dynamic here is how insulated the client is. Because, like, what if we experience a catastrophic macroeconomic event, say a repeat of the 2008 financial crisis, and all those commercial mortgages default?
Or the corporate bond market just completely seizes up.
Right. The insurance company's portfolio might suffer massive losses, but the client's account balance, it does not drop at all. The insurance company is legally obligated to dig into its own capital reserves and pay that guaranteed 4%.
Exactly. So the insurer bears the entirety of the investment risk. The client's principal is totally shielded from market volatility. And because the client is not taking on investment risk, the Supreme Court and the SEC have definitively stated that this product is not a security.
It's just a pure insurance contract.
Right. Therefore, it requires no SEC registration, there's no prospectus, and the person selling it only needs a state life insurance license. They don't need a FINRA securities license.
Okay, so general account equals insurer risk, which equals not a security. But Volatile Valerie finds a 4% guarantee aggressively boring.
Oh, she hates it.
She knows that over a 30-year timeline, the S&P 500 is going to completely crush a 4% fixed yield. She wants market returns.
And Valerie's demand for equity exposure forces the insurance company to change the plumbing entirely. They cannot mix her aggressive stock market bets into their conservative general account.
The risk profiles are just totally incompatible.
Right. So they divert Valerie's premium into a distinctly different silo, which is called the separate account.
And the separate account is legally segregated from the insurance company's main corporate assets, right? Like, even if the insurance company goes totally bankrupt, the creditors cannot touch the assets held in the separate account.
Exactly. It's totally walled off. And inside that silo, the money is broken down into various subaccounts that function almost identically to mutual funds.
So Valerie can allocate her premium into, like, large cap growth stocks, international equities, high yield bonds, whatever she wants.
Yeah, but by choosing the separate account, Valerie absorbs all the consequences of her choices.
Mm-hmm.
If her chosen tech stock subaccount implodes and drops 40% in a single year, her account value drops 40%.
Ouch. And the insurance company does not step in to make her whole.
Nope. They do not owe her a guaranteed return. Valerie bears the investment risk here. And because the client bears the investment risk, the SEC aggressively claims jurisdiction. This product, ISO security.
And this brings up, honestly, the most reliable linguistic cheat code on the entire Series 65 exam. If you are reading a question and the product has the word variable anywhere in its name, variable annuity, variable life, variable universal life, you instantly know the entire chain of logic.
Yes. Variable dictates that the returns fluctuate. Fluctuating returns dictate the use of a separate account.
A separate account dictates that the client bears the investment risk. And client risk dictates that the product is a registered security.
That linguistic cue is your anchor. Variable means security every time.
Hmm.
It means the representative selling it absolutely must hold a Series 6 or Series 7 license in addition to their insurance license.
And it means the client has to receive a full prospectus detailing all the subaccount fees and historical performance, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so if you are listening to this right now and studying for the Series 65, I want you to pause and run cautious Carl through this logic matrix. Just think about this. If Carl buys a product called a fixed annuity, who is taking the risk?
Just follow the words.
Right. The word fixed is present, which means variable is absent.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, Carl's money bypasses the separate account and flows straight into the general account.
And the massive insurance conglomerate absorbs all the market risk, giving Carl his guaranteed yield.
Exactly. Because Carl has no investment risk, the SEC is completely unconcerned with the transaction. It's regulated strictly by the state insurance commissioner.
So that structural dichotomy, general versus separate, insurer risk versus client risk, that governs literally everything we are about to discuss regarding the products themselves. And we really should begin with the product that's designed to solve a terrifying mathematical certainty for modern retirees, which is annuities.
Yeah, annuities definitely suffer from a massive public relations problem, mostly due to their fee structures, which, you know, we're going to dissect later. But on a purely conceptual level, they really are an elegant solution to a very specific human crisis.
They are. To really understand annuities, you have to contrast them with life insurance.
Right. So life insurance is designed to mitigate mortality risk, like the financial devastation that occurs if a primary breadwinner dies 3 decades before their expected actuarial date. You are insuring against a truncated timeline.
But annuities insure against the exact opposite scenario. They mitigate longevity risk,
which is the financial devastation of outliving your capital.
Exactly. Imagine retiring at 65 with a really healthy portfolio. But then medical science keeps you alive until you are 98. You drain your 401k, you drain your savings, and for the last decade of your life, you are entirely destitute.
Which is a terrifying thought.
It is. So an annuity is basically a contractual transfer of that longevity risk from the individual over to the insurance company.
And the mechanism that actually makes this possible behind the scenes is the pooling of mortality credits, right?
Right. When 1,000 people buy annuities, the actuaries at the insurance company mathematically know that some of them are going to pass away at age 70, leaving capital behind in the communal pool.
And that abandoned capital is then reallocated to fund the payouts for the individuals who live to be 105.
Exactly. You are buying a guarantee that no matter how long your biological clock ticks, the monthly checks will never, ever stop. You physically cannot outlive the payout phase.
So to structure that lifelong payout, an annuity operates on a very distinct chronological timeline, and it's split into 2 totally irreconcilable phases. And I know the exam tests the mechanics of these 2 phases relentlessly.
Oh, heavily. So the first era is the accumulation phase. This is the capitalization period. The client is contributing premiums either as just a single lump sum or through periodic payments over time.
And during this phase, the capital is locked inside the annuity wrapper, and it experiences a massive structural benefit, which is tax-deferred growth.
And tax deferral is just a phenomenal wealth accelerator. Mm. If the underlying investments inside the annuity generate dividends or interest or capital gains year after year, the client does not receive a 1099 tax form.
Which means they pay 0 taxes on that growth while it remains inside the contract. The money compounds with maximum efficiency because the IRS isn't skimming off the top every single spring.
Right. Furthermore, and this is wild, unlike highly regulated retirement accounts such as IRAs or 401ks, the IRS imposes absolutely no contribution limits on non-qualified annuities.
Wait, really? No limits at all?
None. A high net worth executive who has already maxed out all their corporate retirement plans can literally drop a $5 million lump sum into an annuity purely to access that unlimited tax-deferred compounding environment.
Wow. So that tax-deferred compounding environment is the accumulation phase. But eventually, the client reaches retirement and actually needs cash flow. And that requires a fundamental metamorphosis of the contract. The client initiates the annuitization phase.
Yes, they pull a permanent lever. They are instructing the insurance company to transform that accumulated mountain of capital into a guaranteed lifelong stream of monthly income.
We are definitely going to explore the complex taxation of those monthly checks shortly. But before we analyze the payouts, we really must address a critical assumption the exam forces you to make. And it involves the original source of the capital that funded the annuity in the first place.
This is huge. You have to differentiate between qualified and non-qualified annuities.
And this is a classic trap. I hear students misinterpret the word qualified all the time. They assume that if they use their own hard-earned after-tax savings to buy an annuity, it must be qualified because they already paid taxes on it.
Right, but the IRS nomenclature is completely inverted there.
Exactly.
A qualified annuity means the contract exists inside a tax-advantaged retirement shell, technically an employer-sponsored 401k or a traditional IRA.
And because the client funded those accounts with pre-tax dollars, meaning they claimed a tax deduction on their income that year, the IRS views that money as completely untaxed capital.
Therefore, the cost basis of a qualified annuity is strictly zero.
Right. And if the cost basis is zero, it means the IRS has never taken a cut of the principal or the growth. So when the client eventually withdraws money from a qualified annuity, the IRS steps in and taxes every single penny of the distribution as ordinary income.
However, you absolutely must memorize this default rule for the exam. On the Series 65, unless the question explicitly uses the word qualified or specifically states the annuity is held within a 401k or IRA, you must operate on the absolute assumption that it is a non-qualified annuity.
Okay, so a non-qualified annuity is funded with after-tax dollars. The client earned a salary, paid their federal and state income taxes, and then used the leftover cash to purchase the annuity.
Right, and because they have already paid taxes on the principal, their cost basis is equal to the total amount of premiums they contributed. the IRS legally cannot double tax that original principal.
Right, that would be unfair. So the massive advantage here is that when the client begins taking distributions from a non-qualified annuity, they're only liable for taxes on the growth.
Just the earnings that accumulated inside that tax-deferred wrapper. The return of their original principal is entirely tax-free.
Okay, so assuming a non-qualified default is just essential for getting the math questions right. So now, let's observe how our three characters actually utilize the different variations of these products, beginning with the baseline, which is the fixed annuity.
So Cautious Carl hands over his after-tax premium and purchases a fixed annuity. The insurance company absorbs his capital into their general account and guarantees him a strict 3% annual return during the accumulation phase.
And furthermore, they guarantee that when he annuitizes at age 65, he will receive exactly, let's say, $2,000 a month for the remainder of his life.
Right. And because the insurance company holds the investment risk, this is not a security. Carl feels completely secure. He can sleep soundly, knowing his principal is safe from any market crashes.
But the exam rarely tests Carl's peace of mind, right? It tests his blind spots. Carl believes he has completely eliminated risk, but he has actually just traded market risk for a much more insidious threat.
He has massively exposed himself to purchasing power risk, which is commonly referred to as inflation risk. This is the fatal flaw of the fixed annuity.
Yeah, Carl locks in his $2,000 monthly payout. At age 65, that $2,000 covers his mortgage, his utilities, his grocery bill. It provides a very comfortable existence.
But let's project the math forward. Using a conservative historical inflation rate of just 3%, using the rule of 72, where you divide 72 by the inflation rate, we know that the cost of living will literally double in 24 years.
Right. So when Carl is 89 years old, that exact same lifestyle will cost him $4,000 a month. But his fixed annuity check has not increased a single cent. The insurance company is still sending him exactly $2,000.
His fixed income has effectively lost half of its real-world purchasing power. He hasn't lost any nominal dollars. His account balance never went down. But he can only buy half as much food and heating oil.
So by trying to avoid the volatility of the stock market, Carl has practically guaranteed his own slow impoverishment over a long timeline.
Exactly. And volatile Valerie completely recognizes the mathematical suicide of purchasing power risk. She looks at Carl's fixed payout and realizes that inflation will just decimate his standard of living.
So she demands an annuity structure that has the potential to outpace inflation through equity market growth. She purchases a variable annuity.
And boom, the appearance of the word variable instantly triggers our logic matrix. Valerie's capital bypasses the general account and is deposited directly into the separate account.
She allocates her premiums among various subaccounts, taking on the investment risk herself. Consequently, her variable annuity is classified as a security.
But the federal regulation of variable annuities is a notoriously complex trap on the exam. Because the SEC didn't just slap a single law on this product and walk away, the regulatory framework is actually bifurcated between two completely different historical pieces of legislation.
Right, the Securities Act of 1933 and the Investment Company Act of 1940. So to navigate this trap, you really have to mentally separate the physical legal document from the pool of money that it represents.
Yes, exactly. When Valerie decides to purchase a variable annuity, she must sign a binding legal agreement with the insurance company. That contract itself represents the issuance of a brand new security to the public.
And anytime a brand new security is created and offered to retail investors, it falls under the jurisdiction of the Securities Act of 1933.
Because the 33 Act is primarily concerned with initial disclosures, which is exactly why Valerie must be handed a full, detailed prospectus before she signs the paperwork. The contract is regulated by the 1933 Act.
Okay, but once the contract is signed and Valerie's money actually flows into the separate account, the regulatory lens shifts entirely because that separate account is pulling in capital from thousands of different Valerie-type investors.
Right. It pools all those premiums together, it hires professional portfolio managers, and it buys massive blocks of equities and bonds.
Because the separate account functions structurally as a pooled investment vehicle with a board of directors, it meets the statutory definition of an investment company. Therefore, the separate account itself and all the subaccounts within it are governed by the Investment Company Act of 1940.
And the exam will absolutely try to cross those wires. They will present a multiple choice question suggesting the separate account is registered under the 33 Act. You must hold the distinction firm in your mind. Contract equals 1933 Act. Separate account pool equals 1940 Act.
Right. So alongside the complex regulation, Valerie also has to contend with the really complex fee structure of a variable annuity.
Oh, yeah. She is paying administrative fees. She is paying underlying mutual fund expense ratios on all the sub accounts. And she faces these steep surrender charges if she liquidates the contract early.
But the most unique and honestly heavily tested fee is the M&E risk charge.
The mortality and expense risk charge. And to understand why Valerie pays this fee, we really have to look at the specific safety net the insurance company provides during the accumulation phase.
Because even though Valerie is bearing the investment risk in her sub-accounts, the insurance company writes this, like, pseudo-put option into the contract, which is called the guaranteed minimum death benefit.
Right. Let's run a severe market scenario to really illustrate this. Say Valerie invests an initial premium of $100,000 into aggressive tech sub-accounts.
Okay.
A recession hits, the market tanks, and her actual account value plummets down to $60,000. If she were to withdraw her money right then, she would only get $60,000. But tragically, Valerie suffers a fatal accident while the market is down.
Wow. Okay. So this is where the mortality risk materializes for the insurer, because the guaranteed minimum death benefit stipulates that regardless of how terribly the sub-accounts perform, if Valerie dies during the accumulation phase, her beneficiaries will receive at least the original principal amount contributed.
Exactly. Her heirs do not get the devastated $60,000 balance. The insurance company must reach into its own pockets to make up the $40,000 shortfall and hand her heirs the full $100,000.
So the insurance company is absorbing the financial risk of her untimely death overlapping with the bear market.
And that is a substantial liability for the insurer. So they charge the M&E fee specifically to fund that death benefit guarantee across all their accounts. But the crucial detail the exam will test is the timeline of the fee. The M&E charge is only levied during the accumulation phase.
Okay, the logic here is incredibly elegant once you actually see it. Because if Valerie survives to retirement and decides to pull the lever to annuitize converting her pile of capital into a stream of lifetime income, she totally surrenders control of the principal. The accumulation phase permanently ends.
Right. And the absolute second the accumulation phase ends, the guaranteed minimum death benefit ceases to exist. The insurance company's liability to return her initial premium to her heirs vanishes entirely.
And because they are no longer providing that specific structural safety net, they can no longer legally charge her the M&E fee.
Exactly. Accumulation equals M&E fee. Annuitization eliminates the M&E fee.
Okay, so we have Carl suffocating from inflation in his fixed annuity, and Valerie paying high fees for market exposure in her variable annuity. But what if Carl wants a compromise?
He always does.
Right. What if he wants a little taste of equity market returns to fight inflation, but he absolutely refuses to expose his principal to market losses?
Well, Carl's desire for upside without any downside risk drove the insurance industry to engineer a highly complex hybrid product, the indexed annuity, which is sometimes referred to as an equity indexed annuity.
And the core mechanism of an indexed annuity basically links Carl's credited interest rate to the performance of a major stock market benchmark, usually the S&P 500. So if the S&P 500 rallies, Carl's account value increases.
But the defining characteristic, the feature that really appeals to Carl's terror of loss, is the guaranteed minimum floor. The contract stipulates that no matter how severely the underlying index crashes, Carl's return for that year will never drop below a predetermined floor, which is almost always 0%.
So if the S&P 500 drops 30% in a brutal bear market, Carl's account value drops exactly 0%. His principal remains entirely intact. He simply owns no interest that year.
Now, apply our golden rule here. If Carl's account is completely insulated from a 30% market collapse, who is bearing the investment risk of that catastrophic drop?
The insurance company is absorbing the blow. They guarantee the floor.
Right. And because the insurer retains the downside investment risk, current SEC and state regulations stipulate that an indexed annuity is not a security. It is classified as a complex fixed insurance product.
And the exam writers love to set traps here. They will write a question heavily emphasizing that the product tracks the performance of the S&P 500 index, trying to bait you into categorizing it as a security. You must look past the index tracking and focus entirely on the floor.
The floor means insurer risk. Insurer risk means it is not a security.
But, I mean, the insurance company is a for-profit enterprise. They cannot afford to give Carl 100% of the stock market's gains while simultaneously eating 100% of the stock market's losses. The math would literally bankrupt them.
Of course. To finance the expensive downside protection of the floor, they must heavily engineer, restrict, and cap Carl's upside potential.
And the exam expects you to understand the mechanics of how the insurance company limits that upside. There are four specific limiting mechanisms used in indexed annuities. Let's walk through a detailed, multi-step mathematical scenario to demonstrate how these mechanisms actually interact.
Okay, let's do it. We will assume Carl invests $100,000. In a phenomenal year, the S&P 500 index posts a total return of 15%.
All right, so the first mechanism the insurer applies is the participation rate. This metric dictates the specific percentage of the index's return that Carl is actually allowed to capture.
So let's say Carl's contract has an 80% participation rate. He doesn't get the full 15% index return. He gets 80% of 15%.
Right, and 0.8 multiplied by 15 yields 12. So after applying the participation rate, Carl's potential return drops from 15% down to 12%.
Exactly. Then the second mechanism is the cap rate. This is an absolute hard ceiling on the maximum possible return for the year, and it's applied after the participation rate. Let's say Carl's contract has a rigid cap rate of 8%.
So even though the participation rate calculation gave Carl 12%, the cap rate acts as a brick wall. The insurance company simply slices off the top 4%. Regardless of how high the market soars, Carl's return is brutally restricted to a maximum of 8%.
Right. Now, the third mechanism is the spread, which is sometimes labeled the margin or the asset fee. This operates as a flat deduction subtracted from the index return before it is credited to the account. Yes. If Carl's contract has a spread of 2%, the insurer deducts that 2% straight off the return.
And finally, we have the fourth mechanism, which we already discussed.
Yeah.
The floor. The 0% safety net that prevents negative returns in a down market.
So the crucial takeaway for the exam is that insurance companies rarely use just one of these mechanisms. They layer them to suppress the yield. A contract might impose an 80% participation rate, AD, an 8% cap, ADD, a spread.
Right, the upside is severely throttled, which is the inevitable price Carl pays for his 0% floor.
Exactly. But the structural mechanics of how these products grow is really only half the battle. To pass the Series 65, you absolutely must demonstrate a mastery of how the Internal Revenue Service extracts its toll.
Oh yes, taxes. The taxation of annuities is one of the most heavily tested, mathematically rigid subjects on the entire exam, primarily because the rules change radically depending on which phase the contract is in.
So let's tackle the accumulation phase first. Suppose volatile Valerie funded her non-qualified variable annuity with a $100,000 after-tax premium.
Okay.
Over several years of aggressive market growth, her sub-accounts have generated $50,000 in tax-deferred earnings. So her total account value sits at $150,000.
And then Valerie encounters a liquidity crisis. Let's say she needs to buy a new car, and she decides to take a $20,000 partial withdrawal from her annuity. Note that she has not annuitized. She is simply pulling cash out during the accumulation phase.
Right. To understand how the IRS taxes this withdrawal, I want you to visualize the annuity as a cocktail glass holding a layered mixed drink, like a dark and stormy or an Irish coffee.
Okay, I like this.
When Valerie initially opened the account, she poured in her $100,000 of after-tax principal. That heavy, non-taxable principal settles at the very bottom of the glass.
And then over the years, the $50,000 of investment earnings slowly dripped into the glass. That high-proof, fully taxable growth floats on the very top of the liquid.
Exactly. So when Valerie takes her $20,000 withdrawal, she essentially drops a straw into the glass. And the IRS aggressively enforces the LIFO accounting method, last in, first out.
And the last money to enter the glass was the investment earnings. Therefore, the IRS dictates that Valerie's straw must drink from the top of the glass. She absolutely must sip the highly taxable earnings first.
Because her withdrawal is $20,000 and she has $50,000 of earnings floating on top, every single drop of that $20,000 withdrawal is classified as earnings.
Consequently, the entire $20,000 is 100% taxable as ordinary income in the exact year she withdraws it.
She cannot access her tax-free principal at the bottom of the glass until she has completely exhausted all $50,000 of the taxable earnings off the top.
The IRS ensures they get their tax revenue immediately. LIFO ensures earnings come out first.
And of course, forgetful Fred manages to make this scenario even worse. Fred attempts the exact same $20,000 withdrawal from his accumulation phase annuity, triggering the same ordinary income tax on the earnings via LIFO. but Fred is only 52 years old.
Oh no. Because Fred is accessing tax-deferred growth before the statutory retirement age of 59 and a half, the IRS imposes a punitive measure. In addition to his ordinary income tax bracket, Fred is hit with an immediate 10% early withdrawal penalty on the entire $20,000.
Tax friction is enormous.
It really is. So the LIFO rule, drinking the taxable earnings off the top, governs withdrawals during the accumulation phase. But if Valerie decides to officially transition to retirement and pull the lever to annuitize the contract, the taxation mechanics completely transform.
Right, the LIFO glass analogy is completely discarded, and we must now utilize the exclusion ratio.
So when Valerie annuitizes, the insurance company calculates a guaranteed monthly payout based on her accumulated capital and her life expectancy. Let's assume they promise to pay her exactly $1,000 every single month for the rest of her life.
The IRS looks at that monthly check and acknowledges that it contains a mixture of two completely different types of money. A portion of that $1,000 is a return of her original $100,000 after-tax principal, which cannot be taxed again.
But the other portion is the distribution of her tax-deferred earnings, which absolutely must be taxed.
To solve this, the IRS forces the use of the exclusion ratio. Let's use a mechanical analogy here. Imagine every $1,000 check is poured into a centrifuge.
Okay.
The centrifuge spins the money, separating the tax-free principal from the taxable earnings based on a strict mathematical percentage derived from her life expectancy.
Okay, I follow you. So if Valerie's life expectancy actuarial table suggests she will live for 20 years, the formula divides her original $100,000 principal by those 20 years, determining that a specific percentage of every payment represents her principal.
Right. Let's say the centrifuge determines the exclusion ratio is 60%.
That means 60% of every single monthly check, which is $600, is categorized as a tax-free return of her original premium. It is excluded from her gross taxable income.
Yes. And the remaining 40%, $400, is categorized as the distribution of her earnings. And she must pay ordinary income tax on that portion.
Yeah.
Every single month, the centrifuge splits the check the exact same way.
Okay, if you're listening and taking the Series 65 next week, pause and think through the chronological implication of this formula. The exclusion ratio is based on an assumed life expectancy. What happens when volatile Valerie defies the actuarial tables?
She lives too long.
Exactly. What happens in year 21 when she has lived so long that the tax-free portion of her checks has fully refunded all $100,000 of her original principal?
This is huge. Once the original cost basis has been fully recovered, the tax-free portion of the centrifuge is empty. From that month forward, the IRS considers every subsequent payment to be pure profit.
Therefore, every single dollar of the $1,000 check becomes 100% fully taxable as ordinary income for the remainder of her life.
The exam loves to test what happens after life expectancy is surpassed. The tax-free ride ends abruptly. And speaking of taxation traps, we must address the most common misconception regarding variable annuities and capital gains.
Oh, this one gets so many people. Let's say volatile Valerie was invested entirely in large cap equity subaccounts within her variable annuity for 30 years. The stock market generated massive long-term growth.
Right. And because she held those underlying assets for decades, she naturally assumes her earnings will be taxed at the highly favorable long-term capital gains tax rate, which might be 15 or 20%.
This is a devastating assumption. Annuity gains are never afforded capital gains tax treatment. Never. It honestly does not matter if the underlying investments were pure equities held for half a century.
The IRS views the tax-deferred growth inside the annuity as a massive structural advantage. The legislative trade-off for that deferral is that upon distribution, all earnings are taxed at the client's highest marginal ordinary income tax rate.
The character of the underlying investment, whether it was a stock, a bond, or a real estate fund, is completely erased by the annuity wrapper. It is ordinary income only.
Right. So we understand how the IRS taxes the payout, but how does the insurance company determine the actual size of that payout in the first place?
Well, when a client annuitizes, they must select a settlement option. They must instruct the insurer exactly how the longevity risk should be managed. I refer to these settlement options as the death bets because the client is basically forcing the insurer to place a wager on their mortality.
It sounds morbid, but it's true. The underlying math of these settlement options is governed by a singular rigid rule. The longer the insurance company's potential timeline of obligation, the smaller the monthly check will be to the client. The insurer stretches a finite pool of capital over a projected timeline.
Let's examine the extreme ends of the spectrum. Forgetful Fred wants to maximize his cash flow immediately. He demands the absolute highest possible monthly check the insurance company will offer.
To get that maximum payout, Fred selects the life-only option, which is frequently referred to on the exam as straight life.
And by selecting life-only, Fred absorbs maximum risk, transferring minimal risk to the insurer. The contract stipulates that the insurance company is only obligated to issue checks for as long as Fred's heart continues to beat.
The severity of this option cannot be overstated. If Fred annuitizes his $500,000 account on a Monday, receives his first massive monthly payout on Tuesday, and tragically suffers a fatal heart attack on Wednesday,
the contract terminates immediately. The insurance company retains the entire remaining balance of his account. Hundreds of thousands of dollars just vanish into the insurer's mortality pool. His heirs receive absolutely nothing.
Right. Because the insurance company's liability is restricted solely to Fred's unpredictable lifespan, they can afford to offer him the highest monthly yield.
Now, cautious Carl observes Fred's gamble and is just horrified. Carl refuses to risk leaving his wife destitute if he dies prematurely. He is willing to accept a much smaller monthly payout in exchange for a longer guarantee.
So he selects the joint and survivor settlement option.
This option fundamentally alters the insurer's liability. The contract now guarantees that the monthly checks will continue to flow for as long as Carl lives and D for as long as his wife lives. The insurance company cannot close the books on this contract until both individuals have passed away.
And insuring two lives dramatically extends the actuarial timeline of the payout. The insurer must assume they will be writing checks for decades. Because the insurance company is absorbing vastly more longevity risk, Carl's monthly payout will be the lowest among all the standard options.
The exam will routinely attempt to invert this logic. They will construct a scenario implying that joint and survivor provides the highest payout. You must anchor yourself to the risk transfer.
Highest risk of forfeiting capital to the insurer, which is life only, yields the highest payout. Lowest risk of forfeiting capital, which is joint and survivor, yields the lowest payout.
Perfect. So that comprehensive analysis of annuities covers the longevity fix, preventing the exhaustion of capital. We must now pivot to the opposite side of the actuarial coin, the mortality fix, life insurance.
If annuities are engineered to ensure you don't outlive your money, life insurance is engineered to ensure your dependents have capital if your timeline is abruptly severed.
The study materials segment the life insurance universe into two primary categories, term life and permanent life. And utilizing a real estate analogy, it provides immediate conceptual clarity here. Term life is the equivalent of renting an apartment, while permanent life is the equivalent of purchasing a home with a mortgage.
Let's begin with the renter. Term life insurance is the purest distillation of mortality protection. You sign a contract for a strictly defined period, say 20 years. You pay a relatively low fixed monthly premium.
And if you die during that 20-year window, the insurance company delivers a massive tax-free death benefit to your beneficiaries.
However, precisely like renting an apartment, you bill absolutely zero equity. A portion of your premium does not go into a side account. Every dollar pays purely for the mortality coverage and the insurer's administrative costs. There is no cash value component whatsoever.
If you survive to the end of the 20-year term, the policy simply expires worthless. The insurance company does not refund your premiums. They effectively say, congratulations on surviving the term. Thank you for your capital.
And because there is no cash value and no underlying investment mechanism of any kind, term life insurance is not a security. It is pure state-regulated insurance.
Cautious Carl, predictably, detests the idea of paying premiums for 20 years only to walk away with nothing. He wants to build equity. He wants a policy that spans his entire mortal existence, not just a temporary term. So Carl purchases the foundational permanent policy, whole life insurance.
Whole life operates like buying a home with a fixed rate 30-year mortgage. The premium is rigid and level. It is guaranteed never to increase, regardless of Carl's advancing age or declining health.
The policy guarantees a specific death benefit that will pay out no matter when Carl dies, as long as he pays the premiums.
The defining characteristic of whole life is the introduction of equity, referred to as cash value. A portion of Carl's fixed premium pays for the mortality cost, but another portion is funneled into an internal savings mechanism within the policy.
But the regulatory classification hinges on our golden rule. Where does that cash value physically reside, and who bears the investment risk?
Well, the cash value inside a whole life policy is absorbed directly into the insurance company's general account. The insurer guarantees a slow, steady, minimum rate of return on that cash value.
Because the massive insurance conglomerate bears the investment risk to provide that guarantee, whole life insurance is not a security.
So term is pure insurance, not a security. Whole life relies on the general account, not a security. But the rigid, unyielding premiums of whole life can be financially suffocating.
Right. What if a small business owner has a terrible fiscal year and cannot afford their massive whole life premium? The policy could lapse. And this demand for flexibility birthed universal life.
Whenever the word universal appears in an exam question, you should mentally substitute it with the word flexible. Universal life effectively unbundles the rigid structure of whole life.
It allows the policyholder to dynamically adjust their premium payments, increasing them during highly profitable years, decreasing them during lean years, or even skipping payments entirely.
They can skip payments as long as there is sufficient cash value accumulated inside the policy to cover the internal mortality costs deducted by the insurer every month. But where is that underlying cash value invested?
Despite the flexibility of the premiums, the cash value in a standard universal life policy remains firmly anchored in the general account. The insurer still dictates the interest rate, guaranteeing a minimum floor.
Therefore, even with its highly unbundled, flexible structure, universal life is not a security.
This brings us back to volatile Valerie. She wants a permanent policy that lasts her entire life, but she looks at the 3 or 4% guaranteed yields of the general account with absolute disdain.
She wants returns.
She is willing to risk her cash value in the equity markets to achieve higher growth. She purchases variable life.
The trigger word variable appears. Instantly, the logic matrix activates. Valerie's cash value is stripped out of the general account and thrust into the separate account.
She actively allocates her premiums across various equity and fixed income subaccounts. She bears the investment risk of market fluctuations. Consequently, variable life I is a registered security.
But the Series 65 contains a highly specific, highly tested distinction comparing the guarantees of a variable annuity to the guarantees of a variable life policy.
This is a critical nuance. With variable life, Valerie assumes total investment risk regarding the cash value. If she allocates poorly and the market crashes, her cash value can mathematically plummet to zero. There is no guaranteed minimum cash value.
However, what happens to the death benefit if her cash value evaporates? Let's say she originally purchased a $500,000 face amount policy. The market crashes, her separate account is decimated.
She gets hit by a bus the next day. Do her heirs get nothing?
This is the safety net, the exam tests. As long as Valerie has faithfully paid her required fixed premiums, the insurance company provides a guaranteed minimum death benefit.
Even if the underlying cash value is effectively zero, the insurer is legally obligated to pay the beneficiaries the original $500,000 face amount. Variable life guarantees the death benefit, but it does not guarantee the cash value.
Now, combine the features for the ultimate hybrid product. Valerie wants the market-linked growth of the separate account, but she also demands the flexible premium structure of universal life.
She wants to invest in the stock market A&D, skip her premium payments when she feels like it.
She purchases variable universal life, commonly abbreviated as VUL. This product merges the variable separate account with the universal flexibility. It offers the maximum potential upside, the maximum structural control, and the absolute maximum risk of catastrophic failure.
The exam focuses heavily on why VUL is so dangerous. Let's run a disaster scenario. Valerie decides to utilize her universal flexibility and stops paying her premiums for 3 consecutive years.
Simultaneously, a brutal recession hits, and her variable separate account subaccounts lose 40% of their value.
Every single month, the insurance company must deduct the internal cost of insurance, the pure mortality charge, to keep the death benefit active. Because Valerie is not injecting fresh premium dollars, the insurer must drain those costs directly from her rapidly depreciating cash value.
The compounding devastation of market losses and internal deductions creates a death spiral. The cash value drains to zero, and because she isn't paying premiums to support the mortality cost, the policy entirely collapses.
It lapses, and her death benefit vanishes. VUL provides no guarantees if the cash value cannot support the internal costs. And because it contains the word variable, it is a security.
Before we leave life insurance, we must address the complex taxation of the cash value itself, specifically how a client can access it while alive. The Internal Revenue Code grants permanent life insurance a phenomenal structural advantage regarding liquidity.
And forgetful Fred almost triggers a massive tax bill by misunderstanding it. Fred holds a whole life policy that has accumulated $80,000 in cash value over the decades. He needs $40,000 immediately to fund a major home renovation.
Right.
Fred calls his insurance broker and says, I want to initiate a $40,000 withdrawal from my cash value.
A competent broker will immediately halt that transaction and advise Fred to execute a policy loan instead.
The tax difference between a withdrawal and a loan is staggering. If Fred takes a withdrawal, any amount that exceeds his original cost basis, the total premiums he paid in, is subject to ordinary income tax.
But if Fred initiates a policy loan, the IRS views the transaction through an entirely different lens. Taking a loan against the cash value of a life insurance contract is not classified as a taxable distribution.
The IRS essentially views it as Fred borrowing his own money, utilizing the cash value as collateral. The insurance company will charge him an internal interest rate on the borrowed funds, but Fred does not owe a single penny of income tax on that $40,000, regardless of how much investment gain is embedded in it.
It provides immense tax-free liquidity. But the exam writers love to spring the trapdoor associated with policy loans. The tax-free nature of the loan is entirely contingent on the policy remaining active and in force.
If Fred borrows that $40,000 and then subsequently stops paying his premiums, causing the underlying life insurance policy to lapse entirely while the loan is still outstanding, the IRS radically reclassifies the transaction.
The IRS determines that because the policy is dead, the loan will never be repaid. They retroactively classify the forgiven loan as a permanent distribution.
Suddenly, that $40,000 generates phantom income, and Fred owes ordinary income tax on the gains, usually precisely when he doesn't have the cash to pay it.
Tax-free when borrowed. Heavily taxable if the policy lapses with an outstanding balance. Furthermore, the exam frequently tests the arithmetic of an outstanding loan at death.
If Fred dies with that $40,000 loan unresolved, the insurer simply subtracts the loan balance from the final death benefit before distributing the remainder to his beneficiaries.
Speaking of distributing funds to beneficiaries, we must synthesize a critical comparison that is virtually guaranteed to appear on the Series 65. You must be able to contrast the taxation of a life insurance death benefit against the taxation of an annuity death benefit.
The contrast is stark and heavily favors the mortality product. Life insurance death benefits represent one of the most powerful tax shelters in the United States tax code. When a life insurance policy triggers, the death benefit is paid to the named beneficiaries completely and utterly free of income tax.
If Carl holds a $2 million term policy and passes away, his widow receives a check for $2 million and she owes zero federal income tax on that capital.
But reverse the scenario. Volatile Valerie passes away during the accumulation phase of her variable annuity. Over the years, her subaccounts generated $400,000 in pure market gains above her original principal. The guaranteed minimum death benefit triggers, and that massive sum is passed to her children. Do they receive it tax-free?
Absolutely not. The IRS does not extend the life insurance tax shelter to annuity death benefits. The original principal is returned tax-free, but that $400,000 of accumulated gain is fully taxable to her beneficiaries as ordinary income in the year they receive it.
The annuity wrapper defers taxes during life, but it forces a harsh reckoning at death. Life insurance death benefits equal income tax-free wealth transfer. Annuity death benefits equal taxable gains for the heirs.
As we transition into the final segment of our deep dive, we need to explore how the IRS governs the movement of capital between these different products. We must navigate the rules of the 1035 exchange.
Section 135 of the Internal Revenue Code is a powerful utility. It permits a policyholder to execute a direct transfer of capital from one insurance contract to another insurance contract without triggering a taxable event.
It allows you to upgrade or alter your coverage without the IRS seizing a portion of your gains during the transition.
However, the IRS imposes strict directional limitations on these transfers. I conceptualize the 1035 rule as an elevator operating in a very specific building. Imagine a high-rise with two floors.
Life insurance resides on the top floor of the penthouse because it possesses the ultimate luxury, the tax-free death benefit.
Annuities reside on the bottom floor because their gains are burdened with eventual ordinary income taxation.
The structural rule of the 1035 elevator is that it is only permitted to travel laterally across a floor or downward to a lower floor. The elevator's programming strictly prohibits it from ever traveling upward to the penthouse.
Let's map out the permissible lateral and downward movements. A client can exchange an existing life insurance policy for a new life insurance policy. They are moving laterally across the penthouse floor. The IRS permits this tax-free swap.
A client can exchange an existing annuity for a new annuity. They're moving laterally across the bottom floor. The IRS permits this tax-free swap.
A client can exchange an existing life insurance policy for a new annuity. They are taking the elevator from the tax-free penthouse down to the taxable bottom floor. The IRS enthusiastically permits this downward transfer.
But the Series 65 will test the forbidden vector. Forgetful Fred attempts to execute a 1035 tax-free exchange to transfer his heavily appreciated variable annuity into a brand new whole life insurance policy.
Fred is trying to take the elevator up from the bottom floor to the penthouse. The IRS categorically denies this transaction. It is an illegal exchange. But to truly master the concept, you must understand the rationale. Why does the IRS forbid the upward transfer?
It is an exercise in tax preservation. Fred's annuity contains hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxable gains. The IRS is patiently waiting to collect ordinary income tax on those gains, either when Fred withdraws them or when his heirs inherit them.
If the IRS permitted Fred to slide those funds into a life insurance policy via a 1035 exchange, all of those highly taxable annuity gains would instantly be cloaked in the absolute protection of a life insurance contract.
When Fred dies, the payout would suddenly become a completely tax-free death benefit. The IRS would permanently lose their cut of the gains. The government refuses to let you wash taxable gains clean by moving them up the tax advantage ladder.
The directional rules of the 1035 exchange are absolute. However, the exam writers construct a secondary trap regarding these exchanges. A 1035 exchange shields you from IRS taxation, but it provides absolutely no shield against the insurance company's internal fee structure.
This is the surrender charge trap. Suppose Valerie is 4 years into a variable annuity contract that imposes a severe 7-year surrender penalty for early liquidation. She decides she dislikes the subaccount options and executes a completely legal, tax-free 1035 exchange into a new variable annuity with a different carrier.
Because it is a 1035 exchange, she owes zero taxes to the IRS on the transfer. But her original insurance company does not care about the IRS code. They see capital leaving their ecosystem before the 7-year timeline has expired.
They will violently enforce their surrender charge, stripping a massive percentage of her capital on the way out.
To compound the damage, when her remaining capital arrives at the new insurance company to fund the new annuity, that new contract will almost certainly reset the clock, initiating a brand new 7-year surrender period. A 1035 exchange is a tax maneuver, not a fee avoidance maneuver.
The devastating impact of surrender charges leads us seamlessly into the final, overarching regulatory mandate you must understand: suitability. FINRA Rule 2111 and Regulation Best Interest dictate that a broker must only recommend products that align logically and financially with the client's specific profile.
And Forgetful Fred is currently demanding that his broker execute a spectacularly unsuitable transaction. Fred contacts his broker in a frenzy. He has just read a financial blog outlining the massive benefits of variable annuities specifically, the unlimited contributions, and the tax-deferred growth.
Okay.
Fred says, I want to buy a variable annuity immediately, and I want you to place the contract directly inside my traditional IRA.
A Series 65 licensed professional must immediately reject this request, recommending or facilitating the placement of a tax-deferred annuity inside a tax-deferred retirement account like a traditional IRA. It's considered a classic textbook suitability violation by regulators.
To understand why it's a violation, we must analyze the structural redundancy. A traditional IRA is inherently a tax-advantaged shell. Any asset placed inside an IRA, whether it's a mutual fund, a single stock, or a bond, automatically grows tax-deferred. The IRS does not tax the internal compounding of an IRA.
If Fred places an annuity, which is fundamentally a vehicle designed to provide tax deferral inside an IRA, which already provides tax deferral for free, he achieves absolutely zero additional tax benefit. The tax deferral of the annuity is entirely redundant.
But the fees are not redundant. Fred is subjecting his capital to the heavy M&E risk charges, the subaccount management fees, and the brutal surrender periods inherent to the variable annuity, specifically to pay for a tax advantage he already possesses by virtue of the IRA.
The broker is allowing the client to absorb massive restrictive fees for a phantom benefit. State regulators and the SEC will aggressively penalize firms that permit this practice.
The only rare exception where this might be barely justifiable is if the client is utilizing the annuity solely to access a highly specific, guaranteed lifetime income rider that cannot be acquired through any other product.
But for the purposes of the Series 65 baseline, never wrap a tax-deferred product inside a tax-deferred account.
We have deconstructed an enormous amount of regulatory architecture today, from the Supreme Court cases defining separate accounts to the LIFO taxation of withdrawals. To ensure this material is anchored in your memory for exam day, we are going to run a rapid-fire volley of the top five non-negotiable, heavily tested takeaways.
Number one, the linguistic cheat code. The word variable dictates that the client bears the investment risk, the money resides in a separate account, and the product is definitively a security requiring dual SEC and state oversight.
Number two, the bifurcated federal regulation of variable annuities. The physical legal contract itself is governed by the Securities Act of 1933. The pooled subaccounts holding the actual investments are governed by the Investment Company Act of 1940.
Number three, the brutal mathematics of annuity taxation. Withdrawals executed during the accumulation phase are governed by LIFO. The highly taxable earnings are withdrawn first. Payouts during the annuitization phase are governed by the exclusion ratio, which mathematically splits every check into tax-free principal and taxable earnings based on life expectancy.
Number four, the asymmetric taxation of death benefits. A life insurance death benefit passes to beneficiaries completely free of income tax. An annuity death benefit provides no such shelter. The accumulated gains are fully taxable to the heirs as ordinary income.
And number five, the suitability trap. Facilitating the purchase of a variable annuity inside a tax-advantaged retirement shell, like an IRA or a 401k, purely to acquire tax deferral, is a redundant, fee-heavy, unsuitable recommendation that violates fiduciary standards.
If you can internalize the logic behind those five pillars, you will dismantle the insurance product section of the Series 65. But before we conclude, I want to leave you with a final, provocative thought, a concept to wrestle with as you deepen your understanding of risk in the financial markets.
Okay, let's hear it.
We spent significant time analyzing the general account. Cautious Carl adores the general account because the massive insurance conglomerate contractually guarantees his fixed returns and protects his principal. The textbook definition states that the insurer bears the investment risk, completely insulating Carl.
That is the regulatory definition. The client's account balance does not fluctuate with the market.
But consider the actual mechanics of the general account. To generate Carl's guaranteed yield, the insurance company is taking billions of dollars and purchasing massive tranches of long-term corporate bonds, highly leveraged commercial real estate mortgages, and complex debt instruments. They are heavily exposed to the credit markets.
Right.
If the broader global economy experiences an unprecedented systemic cataclysm, a shock severe enough to trigger mass defaults across the corporate bond market and a collapse in commercial real estate, the underlying assets within that general account could be decimated. The insurance company's capital reserves could be wiped out.
It's happened before.
If the insurance company itself goes bankrupt under the weight of those defaults, the legal guarantee they offered Carl becomes nothing more than words on a worthless contract. How safe is an ironclad guarantee if the entity providing it ceases to exist?
It forces us to ask, in the modern financial system, does anyone ever truly escape investment risk? Or is the risk simply shifted to an entity too large to fail until it does?
It is a profound question to ponder as you master the mechanics of risk transfer. You can pass the exam by memorizing the surface rules, but you achieve mastery by questioning the foundations those rules are built upon. Keep analyzing the architecture, trust the logic matrix, and go dominate that Series 65.